Welcome to the Passport Play Podcast with Jonathan Lord. Today's guest, Sean Fury, is an award-winning journalist and author of Rise and Fire, The Origin, Science, and Evolution of the Jump Shot, and How It Transformed Basketball Forever. Hey, Sean, thanks for joining me.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me on.
I understand this book is not meant to be an encyclopedia. However, if it were an encyclopedia, what are the chances that the first entry would begin with the word Steph and the last would end with the word Curry?
Yeah, he's kind of a, you know, I don't think my book has perfect timing with him kind of taking, you know, just taking over the sports world with his jump shooting. But at the same time, the timing was kind of odd because by the time I finished the first draft, he was in the middle of his MVP season, but he hadn't become this shooting god that he's become the last, obviously, this full season, and even at the end of his MVP year. So I obviously write about him, you know, in the book, but now he's become such a dominant force that he's kind of overwhelming everything else. And, you know, I still think if you would have this, you know, hypothetical encyclopedia, that he's definitely the, you know, the latest and the greatest on this, you know, evolutionary track of the jump shot in the game of basketball. But I still, you know, I think you'd still have, you know, hundreds of names of just great shooters that even guys today, sometimes they can kind of get lost, you know, with Curry's greatness. And certainly the guys in the past, you know, no matter what Steph does, it doesn't take away, you know, from what Larry Bird or Dale Ellis or, you know, just on and on and on. Any great shooter from the past, what they did. It's just that he's such an overwhelming force right now that he kind of overshadows everyone else.
That's really funny you mentioned the timing of this book, Rise and Fire, because as I was reading it, I couldn't help but think that part of you must have hoped that you could have pushed back the release date just a little bit. I know there's some on Steph, but part of me was thinking that you could have pushed the release date back just a little bit to include a bit more, because, I mean, I don't... My history with the sport goes back some time, but I can't recall seeing, and many people would agree, seeing as prolific a shooter as Steph Curry. And it's not just that he makes such a high percentage, it's that he makes them from all over the court, right? He's got no range because he can hit shots from everywhere. And I can't recall seeing another jump shooter like him, can you?
Yeah, no, I think that's what, you know, separates him is the distance and then also the accuracy, because, you know, a funny thing, talking to a lot of, in my research, and then when you talk to a lot of the old players, especially if they're, it's like, you know, before there's a lot of film on, you know, every game being taped, you'd hear stories about guys shooting from 30 feet, 35 feet, and, you know, I kind of always take those with a grain of salt because, you know, obviously everyone gets better in their memories and it's just impossible to verify some of those things. But with him, we have this nightly proof that he is shooting from these ridiculous distances. But he's also just incredibly accurate. You know, his accuracy is up there with, you know, like the type of guys that we just think of when we think of just like people who specialize in shooting, you know, just standstill shooters. You know, you think of like Kerr when he played with Jordan and Duncan, you know, he would wait for the superstars to draw the attention and knock down the shots. But Curry shoots with percentages that rival those guys. And then adds in the distance and then the fact that he's doing it against double teams, doing it off the dribble. It's just, it's certainly something that, you know, his entire package is definitely, I think, unique to NBA history.
And I don't know if he helps change your argument. I don't even know if your book ultimately decides what the answer is, but I thought one of the fascinating aspects of Rise and Fire was that you tackle the million-dollar question, the age-old question, is something like a jump shot nature or nurture? And I don't know if you can decide one way or another. I think you present both cases clearly. But in the case of Steph Curry, I think you can argue a little bit of both, right? I mean, I think you can obviously say that he has a lot of natural ability, talent. But then I also think you can say that it sure does help that he grew up the son of another prolific jump shooter, Del Curry, and he was hanging around the NBA arenas, and I don't know who it was who said this. I think it was Bill Simmons on his podcast. They were talking NBA, they were talking Steph Curry, and he mentioned something about how at a very young age, Curry's at NBA gyms, shooting in NBA arenas, shooting with a you know, a real basketball, a full-size basketball. And in your book, you do talk about how for shooters, it does take some adjustment getting used to arenas and backdrops and the workplace, so to speak. So nature versus nurture, how do you weigh in on Steph Curry with that one?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right with all those points you make. I guess the one argument against, you know, how much the nurturing is, you know, how many other, obviously, NBA players over the decades have had countless children that haven't turned into a player like Steph. So, you know, how much is it growing up? And, you know, it certainly helped him, but it seems like if it was more important that you'd see more, you know, NBA players producing these types of players. Of course, with Golden State, it's funny because they do have two, you know, Klay Thompson, who some nights is an even better shooter than Curry, is also, you know, obviously the son of a former player too. And, I've, you know, there's been stories where they both guys talk about, and both of the dads, Michael and Dell, talk about how they think that upbringing certainly helped their son. So it's just such a tough question, especially with Curry, because he does have, you know, you see people say he's not maybe the most, you know, he doesn't have the athletic gifts, obviously, of like a LeBron or a Jordan, but, I mean, his physical package is still pretty awesome when you talk about the quickness, you know, just the hand-eye coordination, just the physical skills he does have, and then the countless hours of work he's put into the ball handling that allows him to get free for his shots. So it's just, with him, I think it is that kind of perfect combination of, he grew up in it, but then, so you have that advantage, but then he also had this drive, you know, even in high school and then not being highly recruited, I think that motivated him as well at Davidson. And then coming into the pros, I think people expected him to be good. I wanted the Wolves to draft him ahead of Johnny Flynn, of course, but obviously no one expected what he's become. And so that, I think, once you reach a certain point, you have to credit the work that he's done, in addition to recognizing that, you know, he did have some advantages growing up with Dell.
How much do you buy into this whole argument, this old school, new school argument that, I guess, can we say originated with Oscar Robertson regarding Steph Curry, as far as, you know, Steph is assisted nowadays because of the rules, and the rules are in place to favor the scorer, the outside shooter. And back in the day when the Big O was playing, the rules were defense. There was more focus on, you know, the bigger players, and you could get away with a little bit more when it comes to defense. Do you buy that Steph is certainly a product of the new rules of the game, or do you think that he is just he'd be great regardless of the era he played in?
I kind of a little bit of both, because first, I'm probably more sympathetic to old school guys than a lot of people, especially online. I think the, you know, basketball world tends to be more, you know, kind of those grouchy old guys, don't they just shut up sometimes, or they, you know, they're just idiots. But I think it's kind of both, because I do think it's ridiculous for any of the older players to say, if we were playing today, or if our guys were playing today, this, you know, we would stop Steph this way. They wouldn't. If today's players, today's coaches, you know, the best in the world, the best athletes today, the best players, tremendous, you know, scouting advantage, all the analytical advantages they have. If they can't figure out a way to stop Steph, that, you know, someone, just because you played in an era where you could throw more elbows and you were transported to today's game, today you're not going to be able to stop him. But I do think, you know, and I write about this in my book when I, you know, talk about the greatest shooters ever, and I do think it's fair to say that Steph is a product of his era, in that obviously if he's played in the 70s, there would be no three-pointer, and he uses the three to such a great advantage. Not to say he would, you know, still be a great shooter, because there were great high-scoring shooters back then, but he might not be as dominant just because the game wasn't played that way. Even if he played in the 80s, you know, the NBA just didn't shoot three-pointers like they do today, and if he was magically transported back there, he would be playing the way, you know, players play then, not how the guys play today. So I think it's fair to say that, you know, he's the greatest, you know, greatest shooter, obviously, of this era of the three, where the three-point ball reigns. But I think it's, you know, he'd be a totally different player if, obviously, he was playing in the 60s, 70s, 80s. And that's why it's so hard, I think, to compare. We talk about the greatest shooters, because at the same token, if, we talk about these guys who have the great mid-range games of, whether it's Jerry West or those guys in the 80s, Bernard King, those types of players, but if they grew up today, they would not be developing those mid-range games. They'd be like everyone else shooting the threes. So it's just so hard to compare eras like that.
So then what is, if we can't compare eras, then what is the common denominator with jump shooters? What is the commonality that exists in all these great ones? You mentioned West and Bernard King, Steph Curry, go on down the line. All the guys that you mentioned in your book, and you mentioned a heck of a lot of them, is there one common denominator that unites them all that we can say, this is the trait of all great jump shooters, regardless the era?
That's a good question. I don't know if I'm trying to think of like one thing. I think the thing that they all had in common as players is when you read from their, their peers or their opponents, just the sense of fear that they could instill in the opposition, like the names you mentioned. I found some old quotes from in the early 60s of a coach going against Jerry West, and he said, he crosses half court and he rises up for a shot that there's absolutely nothing you can do. And that's a quote that you could take today and put, I'm sure we've heard it from people talking about Steph Curry. And you go through all the shooters from, every era there, from the, especially the 60s on, where it really became, much more weaponized shot. And I think that's a common thing, where just a sense of helplessness that these great shooters kind of brought to defenders, where you can double team them, you can triple team them, you can put tall guys on them, but when a great shooter is kind of in their rhythm, there's nothing you can do. And that's something that I think is translated over the eras. And it's something I really enjoy. I write about in the book, it's the old saying, it's kind of a cliche, but great offense will beat great defense. And when you have a great shooter, I think that's more true than in any other situation, because no matter where they are in the court, and no matter whether they played in the 60s or today, when they get locked in, there's really nothing you can do. So I think that's kind of maybe the most common thing. And then obviously you just talk about the work ethic that all these guys put in, just thousands of hours, a lot of times working alone. I talked to a guy who, he has a theory that great shooters are more often introverts compared to extroverts, because they kind of go inside themselves and just want to work by themselves. So I think that, could be something that you might see in a lot of the great shooters, but at the same time, I'm sure you can probably find many who, were very outgoing or sociable. So, but, I do think of, like West and, Larry Bird kind of growing up by himself, and just a lot of these guys who really did work on it on their own. So that might be another common trait there.
And confidence too, right? You've got to have you've got to have the confidence to miss four or five in a row and then keep shooting. I'm sure that was something that popped up more than once or twice.
Yeah, definitely. It reminds me of a quote from Rick Mount, one of a great shooter at Purdue. And when I asked him I kind of knew what the answer was going to be, but I asked him if he considered himself the greatest shooter ever. And he said, well, of course I do. And he goes, if a shooter doesn't say that answer, then they shouldn't even be in the conversation for who the greatest shooter is. Because if they don't have that confidence in themselves, and if they haven't shown that on the court, then, they shouldn't be considered the best ever. So I think all these guys, some of them maybe are more politically correct, and I'll name someone else who's the greatest shooter, but I think if they're being honest and, you ask Curry, I'm sure he would think he's the greatest ever, and I think Bird would have, and even though they say other guys, but when the ball is in their hands, and whether it's the closing seconds or, any time in the game, they certainly feel, even if they've missed 10 straight shots, that the next one is always going to go in, and that's definitely something. You don't see these guys suffering from crises of confidence very often.
Yeah, I still think one of the greatest exhibitions of jump shooters' confidence was that All-Star Game 3-point contest when Larry Bird refused to take up his warm-up.
Yeah, that was kind of that 3-year period there where he won the 3-point contest was kind of his, shiny moment as far as his, outright arrogance, really, the first year when he came in and famously asked everyone else in the locker room, all right, who's shooting for second place here? And then the next year he won, and then that in Chicago Stadium in this old Celtics warm-up, and it comes down to the last ball, and he shoots it and puts his finger up because he knows it's going in. And like you said, that just shows that these guys always think they're going to be the one, which makes it kind of fun when you see like the 3-point contest this past year with Curry and Thompson, because the two best shooters going at it, and on that night at least, Thompson was the best, and I'm sure Thompson, he probably has that confidence too, even though he's playing with arguably the greatest shooter ever, but I'm sure every time he steps on the court, he thinks he's the best out there too.
What about the actual science of the shot itself? Because if you watch, you know, a lot of shooters today and in the past, they're not always leaving the ground. So the idea that the jump shot, you have to leave the ground, is not necessarily true. How exactly would you explain the science of the jump shot? If it's not jumping into the air, then what is it exactly that defines a jump shot?
Yeah, that's, I think a name you'd probably think of right away with that is Bird, of course, because he barely left the court. And even Curry, you know, he doesn't jump right real high with it.
Which is funny because in preparing for this podcast, I was embarrassingly about to, and I'm going to ask you now, I was going to ask you if they can even qualify as jump shooters because they aren't leaving the ground.
Yeah, no, I think they still do it. And I actually, with Bird in particular, when I was, because there was an old quote in Sports Illustrated, I think it was Danny Ainge, who said one of Bird's advantages in those three-point contests was he didn't use as much energy because he didn't leave the ground. And so I actually, you know, would look at the videotape and make sure, okay, his feet, even if they're leaving 6 inches, I'm calling that, you know, a jump shot, especially because there were actual, you know, set shots way back when. So I'm giving those guys as jump shots, even, you know, whether you jump 12 inches or 6 inches off the ground. But, I think of a Dominique Wilkins. He had a quote when he was talking about his shot where he sometimes, not surprisingly, jumped too high on his jump shot. He kind of had to be able to learn to control that.
Yeah.
And that's something you don't really think about. But when you think about the guys who, you know, jump really high, they're not necessarily going to be the best shooters. But it also depends. It's just once these guys develop their form, whether it's jumping barely off the ground or, you know, flying off the ground, I think it becomes such muscle memory that if they perfect whatever their particular form is, I think that's what they have to go with. And, you know, it's interesting when you look at how just shooting forms have changed over the decades, and obviously, I think a lot of it does actually play into the three-pointer again, too, because you had these guys in the 80s. It seemed like saw a lot more, you know, funky jump shot forms. You think of Jamal Wilkes and his crazy behind-the-head shot, and those types of shots, and I talked to a coach who mentioned this, really wouldn't probably work well today with a three-pointer because it's harder to shoot that way from, you know, say 23 feet, 9 inches. Those were great shots for 15 feet, 18 feet. So as the rules have changed, I think it's also changed shooting forms. And now you see guys, you know, you see a lot of, you know, great-looking form jump shots, but they don't look like what we would consider picture-perfect form back in, say, 1970. So I think it's interesting just how the rules itself can kind of change how the game has evolved with the form and the science of it.
What surprised you the most when researching the history of the jump shot? Was there anything that popped out at you about the first jump shooters or some of the origins of the jump shot, when people first started talking about this new type of shot? Is there anything that kind of just stood out for you as maybe was surprising, something you learned in the process? What jumped out at you about the foundations of this jump shot?
Is something that was probably the most surprising. That's something I didn't really know anything about when I first started really researching it. And whether it was, you know, in the 1930s, you had these guys kind of doing it scattered across the country, different parts of the states, whether it was south or west or east. And there they would meet resistance a lot of times from their coaches, where the coach would, you know, grew up on the set shot, and this is how you play the game, and you don't leave the court ever. So the coaches would sometimes, first they'd be like, you know, what the hell is that shot? Or they would threaten them with benching. Sometimes they did bench them until these guys proved, you know, usually with really high scoring marks, especially for their day, that, you know, they knew what they were doing. And then even as you progressed into the 40s and 50s, and then especially the mid to late 50s, I found just a ton of stories from newspapers where there was just a lot of resistance from the media. There was a lot of kind of that traditional, stereotypical, like we talked about earlier, just the grouching about the things were better in the olden days. You know, back in the 30s and 40s, they played defense. And it was really surprising to me to see guys saying that the jump, and they blamed it on the jump shot. They said the jump shot is ruining basketball because it's making offense so easy. It's giving power to individuals, kind of taking away from the teamwork. You know, you didn't see as much passing, maybe. The give and go was lamented as being a product of a bygone era. And that was really shocking to me, just to see this great shot that more and more players were using in the 50s. And he had these writers saying that it was bad for basketball. And again, it kind of ties into today when you see someone, you know, complaining about Curry or something. But it's kind of been a thing where the jump shot has always kind of caused some unease amongst people.
Yeah, what took so long? Are you saying that it was more than just the coach's resistance to a new kind of shot? It was also the media's resistance? I mean, the physical advantages of a jump shot are obvious to us. You know, you avoid you avoid defenders, you extend your range, all these things that make sense now. But it seems as if you're saying that people were dissuaded from taking jump shots because they were not normal.
Yeah, I think, I don't know how much the media would be to blame, or, you know, the media was kind of complaining about it, but I think a lot of it might have also just been, especially those guys in the 30s and mid and early 40s, if a player, you know, never just, they were so scattered that players really didn't see other guys doing this. So even if a player was doing an incredible job, if you don't see everyone else doing it, and the way you've trained, the way you've practiced, and, you know, the shot you're comfortable with is the set shot, it must have been very difficult for those guys to change, especially if you get, you know, talking like Division One or what the Pro Bowl was for the time. I mean, these are the best in the game, and it's going to be hard for them to do such a dramatic shift. But although, like you said, to us it seems so obvious. Like, why weren't the first players jumping in 1891? You know, what was taking them so long? I just think it was the sense of tradition, and that you'd had 4 or 5 decades of it being the set shot. And then just, I think, the difficulty of those early guys kind of trying to develop this shot, because it was something, you know, Kenny Saylor's a player I write about, and he talked about how, you know, he took his first jump shot in 1934, and then he won a title at Wyoming in 1943, went and fought in World War II, and then finally came back, and he said it was by the late 40s that he finally perfected his shot. So you're talking 12 years there where he was working on it before he felt comfortable with it. So I think with a lot of it was probably just, it was such a foreign shot, if you will, that they didn't really want to change it. And it took until more people saw it, until you had, you know, several players on the court doing it. And then I think eventually players were just kind of forced to adapt eventually.
It's funny, the way you're describing the jump shot is how a lot of people would talk about, like, the dunk, the slam dunk.
Yeah.
You know, like, I'm more familiar with people's resistance, at least in the history of basketball, the resistance against the slam dunk, right? And wasn't there a period in basketball history where it was outlawed? Right. You couldn't dunk the basketball because it was just making the game too easy for the likes of Wilt Chamberlain. And it's funny to think about the jump shot in very similar terms as the slam dunk.
Yeah, like I said, that was something that I didn't know about with the jump shot. And, you know, you talk about famously the NCAA, you know, banned it when Kareem / Louis Cinder was so dominant in the late 60s, and they got rid of it totally for several years, although Kareem credits it with, you know, he then developed his hook shot because of that. But it was, you know, such, like I said, the late 50s era, Jimmy Breslin, you know, famous newspaper columnist, at the time was just a young sports writer, but he was one of the guys who wrote columns about the jump shot ruining basketball. And a big thing, too, I think, was that idea that, and a lot of them wrote about this, is that this is kind of a thing of basketball, too, where it's the ultimate team game, and it's beautiful when it's played, you know, 5 guys working together. And the jump shot really allowed a player to stand out. And I think it was Dick McGuire, the Hall of Famer. He was a player at the time with the Knicks. And he would talk about, you know, my team comes down and we do 5 or 6 passes to get a guy open. The other team comes down and gets it to one guy, and he takes one dribble and jumps out of the gym and makes a basket. It's just too easy. So I just think that idea that it made the game easy, which, strangely, not that it makes sense, but people would get upset about it. You'd think it'd be a good thing that it was increasing scoring and making offense more, you know, easier for the players, but that wasn't always so.
And how much of the early resistance against the to the jump shot do you think was a black and white thing? Because you did talk about how segregation made it a little harder to uncover the true origins of the jump shot. Do you think race played a factor in people's resistance to the jump shot at first?
I don't think it did with the jump shot. I think obviously with the dunk, I think that was something that was certainly a factor, and because. Not just guys like Kareem, but just the high flyers of that era. I think that was more so. Where the jump shot, I don't think it was so much because like I did write about in the book. Unfortunately, guys in the 30s, black players at the time, whether they were barnstorming or playing in colleges, there's not a ton of accounts about them because of the media back then. But that's also the case with the majority of players anywhere. That just wasn't the media attention, especially for basketball. Basketball was not. Obviously, it was very minor compared to, say, baseball or even boxing. So a lot of players didn't get that coverage. So I don't think it was so much a racial thing with a jump shot because especially even in the 50s when you had these guys complaining about it, they would outright name players who they thought were shooting too well, but it was always white players. It was Frank Selvey from Furman. People would talk about this Robin Freeman from Ohio State. And so I don't think it was necessarily along racial lines. It was more just something new and something scary for the old school guys.
What about your backstory? Your history is interesting because I thought part of what made the narrative in Rise and Fire so captivating is that you interjected a lot of personal stories in with the backstory of some of the players. You talk about growing up in the Midwest and how that had a significant factor on your appreciation for the jump shot. Do you find that the jump shot, or at least the origins of the jump shot, is a regional thing? I mean, I know you're a Midwestern guy, so you're going to stand up for your other Midwestern guys, but I found that there was a lot of stuff on players from, not just Minnesota, but also Indiana and the Heartland. And how much of your research was dedicated to that part of the country because, A, that's where a lot of the good jump shot shooters came from, or B, that's where your sentiment lies?
I think it was more especially for the Indiana part, as you said, that was more just because there were so many great shooters from there. As a Minnesotan, I can't say I necessarily have any extra affection for Indiana or anything. Obviously, the parts where I wrote about, whether shooting my grandpa's farm or, my playing some high school ball, obviously that's, related to my upbringing and growing up in Minnesota, growing up in a small town where, maybe I shot all the time because there really was nothing to do. But with the Indiana, it was more just, I knew going in, and then also just as I researched, you had just all these guys who were also kind of famous for their shooting, not just great players, but I write about Rick Mount and then a player named Jimmy Rail from Indiana who were kind of these, they were just known as these shooting savants, and that, their all-around games were okay, but mostly it was that shot that just made them these gods in the state, and just that idea really appealed to me, and you seem to find that more in Indiana, partly because it's just obviously a basketball haven in the states, but then obviously it produced Larry Bird and Oscar Robertson, who, two of the best ever, and I wrote about those guys, so I think for that part, it was more just the players that came from there, not necessarily my pro-Midwest bias, even though I certainly have that. But when I wrote a little bit about kind of the regional aspect, and one thing that interested me was, the New York City guys. I wrote about this kid that I played ball with, and, he talked about, he was a great point guard himself, and he said, New York City point guards, we don't shoot as much, but I think if you look at it, you'll find just as many great New York City shooters as anywhere else. It's just that they might be known for different parts of their game. But so I try to explore a little bit the regional part in different parts of the country, and because I think it is interesting. You hear like this player named Raymond Lewis that I write about in California, and you see these stories, and he never played in the NBA, but people still talk about him as maybe being one of the best shooters to ever come out of California. But who's ever really heard of him? So I always like just those stories where guys' shooting ability really makes them stand out, whether they, were also, maybe they weren't great all-around players, but just those shooting skills really made them stand out. And I think that's something that you kind of see throughout the country, not necessarily just in the Midwest.
I think it's boredom. I don't think there's a lot going on in the Midwest.
That's definitely for me growing up. Like I said, we were about an hour and a half south of Minneapolis, and you know, back then we never really went anywhere. So I had the basket at the neighbors. I had the basket a block away at the city park, and then the basket at my grandpa's. So you know, that's what we did. And yeah, there might be some. You know, there would have to be. I'm not going to make any broad statements because someone could do some analytical study, but there probably is something to, you know, that idea that, or maybe it also goes back to the guy who talked about introverts.
Yeah.
You know, they're just kind of in themselves and, you know, just content to be by themselves. And, you know, growing up where there's not a lot to do, maybe that does play into it as well.
Yeah. Or the nature nurture, right? This is the old Malcolm Gladwell, the argument here, right? 10,000 hours.
Yeah. So
maybe it is, yeah. Maybe it does come down to having the time. And you talk about, you know, this is throwing a massive blanket over the entire region, but perhaps there's more time on the farm.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I wrote about even the two Iowa girls basketball players that I wrote about who played, and one of them was the first woman drafted in the NBA, and both of those girls, one grew up on a farm, and she herself said, you know, there was nothing to do, so we put a basket up and just shot hour after hour, and the other girl grew up in a town that had, you know, a couple hundred people, and again, there was a basket in the town, and that was about it. So that's all she did, and she would shoot out there 4 or 5 hours a night until she became this, you know, literally a basketball goddess in Iowa back then.
Now, you did me such a huge favor by writing about Bobby Plump, who most of us know as Jimmy Chitwood from the movie Hoosiers, and I'm so appreciative of you to include the real history of Milan over Muncie Central and Indiana State Championship 1954. Do you mind explaining a little bit of that story and how it connects to the history of the jump shot? Because, you know, the actor who played Jimmy Chitwood had a fantastic looking jump shot, but I'm guessing Bobby Plump's jump shot was even prettier.
Well, that's, and as you said that, I realized that's, you know, when we're talking about Indiana, that's obviously another chapter in Indiana that I wrote about. And that one was, you know, kind of the hook for me, at least, was this one jump shot that changed someone's life, and that someone was Bobby Plump, who you mentioned. And so Bobby Plump, he starred on the 1954 Milan team that they were the smallest school to win the state title. Back then, Indiana famously had a one-class state tournament, and he actually had a very good team his junior year. They made it to state semis, and then the next year, they made it and won the state tournament. And along the way, they beat Crispus Attucks out of Indianapolis, famous for having Oscar Robertson on their team. He was a sophomore at the time. And the 2 years after that, Oscar and his team won the state title. So, you know, to know that Milan beat those guys, you know what kind of team they were. So in the state finals, a very low-scoring game. And, you know, they kind of held the ball, which they would do sometimes, but against Crispus Attucks, they ran up and down the court and kind of ran them off the court. So they could play any style, but Plump talked about how that last game, you know, comes down to the last minute, and he's just holding the ball like Jimmy was famously in Hoosiers. And he waited till, you know, the clock ran down, then made his move and got to the right elbow at the free throw line and hit his shot. And he talked about, you know, I had a chance to speak with him about how he saw a player in his tiny school shooting a jump shot and thought, wow, that's, you know, a remarkable play. And then he started working on it more so than the other guys on his team. And by the time he made it, he was a great shooter. And then he went on to Butler and had a very good career there. So that was a really fun chapter for me to write, because then, of course, 30 years later, it inspired Hoosiers. And like you said, Jimmy Chitwood, and, you know, Hoosiers is my all-time favorite movie. And I had the chance to visit the Hoosier Gym in Indiana, which was where they filmed the home games for Hickory, the fictional team in Hoosiers. So it was just really fun to talk to Bobby about how that one shot that he made when he was 18 years old is still, you know, he's 79, I think, now. And we were at his restaurant in Indianapolis, and a half dozen times during our talk, we were interrupted by people who just wanted to come talk to him and say, you know, hey, Mr. Plump, and one guy must have been in his 80s or 90s, and he said it was, you know, the highlight of his life, getting a chance to talk to Bobby Plump. So you just saw the power of that one jump shot. And it's kind of remarkable how that one thing changed his life. And inspired a movie, and then that movie inspired people after that. So that was a really fun chapter to write. And then I compared it in that chapter as well with Troy Lewis, a former Purdue star, who also in the one class state tournament had a jump shot that would have won the state, but his missed. So I thought it was kind of an interesting comparison with the guy who made it and the guy who missed, and just how in Indiana those two shots just affected these guys' lives so much.
How different the climax of Hoosiers would have been if Jimmy Chitwood had taken a set shot that was blocked 10 rows deep.
Yeah, exactly. It probably wouldn't have been the box office hit it was. And Plump talked about it, you know, kind of along those lines, where he said his defender was sort of playing off him as he was holding the ball. And as he dribbled, the guy gave him enough room where he had the shot from 15 feet. And he said, if he would have been playing up on me, you know, I would have gone in towards the basket and tried for a layup. Which even that, you know, you picture Jimmy Chitwood making a game-winning layup. To me, that's not as exciting.
No.
Either as, you know, pulling up, the, you know, the camera zooming in on him. And so I'm glad they followed the real-life thing there, because, he, you know, he did pull up just like Jimmy did. It was kind of interesting researching some of the differences between the movie and a lot of the similarities. When the movie came out, a lot of people in Milan were unhappy because they were sort of hoping that it would take, you know, their entire story, and instead it's, you know, fictionalized certain parts. So even some of the people there didn't like it for that reason. But there were a lot of similarities. One of the players had an alcoholic father, who was obviously what Shooter was based on. And, you know, a lot of the Jimmy stuff, you know, Jimmy in the movie, super quiet, kind of this mute genius. And Bobby Plump said when he was in school, he hardly ever spoke. He was a very shy kid. And it took, you know, once he made that shot and became this celebrity in Indiana and spoke to groups and people, you know, hundreds and hundreds over the years, where now he's a very outgoing, confident, gregarious guy. But he was very Jimmy-like in school.
From savant to celebrity, I'm going to ask a question that I don't really want the answer to, but I have to ask it. In your discussions with Bobby Plump, did he happen to mention whether or not he did say those famous words, "I'll make it"?
I don't think he did, no. I can't remember. I don't think I asked him that, but...
It all comes crashing down.
I know. I think that was fictionalized. And speaking of crashing down, this was an interesting thing to me. Apparently, and obviously anyone who's seen the movie will remember Holly, the, you know, terrible granny shooting free throw guy at the end of the bench.
Yeah, they're coming back.
Holly and... Apparently, yeah. Ollie in real life was the best player out of all those guys. He was a really good player, but he had to, you know, be the short, terrible guy in that team. But in the director's commentary for Hoosiers, which I bought that DVD in Hoosier Gym, even though I have like three copies already, the director's talking about the famous scene in the schoolyard when Jimmy's out there shooting by himself, and Gene Hackman, a.k.a. Norman Dale, walks out and, you know, gives him that famous speech about, yeah, I don't care if you play or not. It's kind of, you know, a great little motivational ploy there.
Yeah.
But in the scene, Jimmy's just making shot after shot after shot.
Yep.
And in the commentary, the director and the writer say that they loosened the rims to make it easier for Jimmy's shots to roll in.
No. No.
I know. I heard that. And, you know, I felt like throwing a remote, but.
Oh, no. Things I don't want to know.
I know. He was making them, though, on his own for the most part. And I think the final shot in the movie, I think they said, you know, because they were actually struggling to find people to fill the stands, because, you know, no one really knew what this movie was going to be, but he made the shot when he had to at the buzzer in the movie, and that was real. So he was a great shot, but they did things to help him, and that kind of damaged me as well.
Yeah, some things you're just better off not knowing, and that I have put that movie in the pantheon since the first time I saw it when I was a kid. And I got to tell you that I want all of it to be true. And I find the story so captivating. And the fact that it ties in with the work that you've put forward here in Rise and Fire is, I mean, I probably wasn't motivation for writing the book, but at the same time, it was probably a nice benefit of getting to write the book.
Oh yeah. It was. And one thing, you know, when I was in Indiana for a few weeks, you know, driving around talking to different guys, and I definitely made a point of it to drive to Hoosier Gym and, you know, spend some time there, because, you know, this is like my cathedral, and it's in this small town of about 2,000 people. This, you know, school is obviously not in use anymore. The the gym, but it's, you know, just in the middle of town, and you find it, and there was, like, no one parked there, and I was just picturing in my mind, you know, this place is just going to be overflowing with tourists. You know, everyone's going to come to the Hoosier Gym, and for about 45 minutes, I was completely by myself in there, and so then and you can get a basketball, you can shoot, you can do whatever you want, so I was just going through and taking Jimmy shots, and I shot where they shot when Shooter drew up the old picket fence, so that was definitely a thrill of the book, just going down there and kind of savoring that moment. And obviously a lot of it was because Hoosiers, you know, it probably is my favorite movie of all time. But then also just knowing that it was based on this real guy, that, you know, if Bobby Plump doesn't make that shot in 1954, then there isn't this movie about a fake 1952 team. So that was really fascinating to me. But I definitely, I mean, it just ate up every moment that I was in that gym.
You've inspired me. Next time I'm driving through Indiana, I'm going to find eight other basketball players, not nine, eight, and I am going to play a game of 4-on-5, just as Norman Dale would like it.
Well, that's fine. I think you can rent it for really cheap. I think it was like $30-$35 for an hour. And I was thinking, you know, even if I live like a half hour away from there, I'd be, you know, getting my buddies every week just to go play there. But, and it sounds like people do, you know, rent it out once in a while, but not, I mean, if I was there, they'd be throwing me out because I'd be using it so much. But, yeah, and then you could have some, and there's volunteers there, so, and they're usually, you know, older guys, very nice, very knowledgeable about the town and the area and the gym. And so you could have him sit on the bench and, you know, say my team's on the floor when it's just you four out there.
I don't think this is such a crazy idea, and in fact, I think this is becoming bucket list material.
No, I don't know if it was on my bucket list before I started writing this book, but then once I knew I was going, I always read about the Hoosier Gym and, you know, thought it was this awesome thing, but once I actually got to Indiana and then realized how close I was to it, then it became something like, oh yeah, and my birthday, I just recently saw my birthday at that time, and I was like, I mean, this is a birthday present to myself. So it was definitely, I think anyone who's seen the movie, a friend of mine in Minnesota who's seen it probably as much as me, and I told him about it, and he kind of said the same thing, like if he is driving through Indiana sometime, he wants to make a point of going there.
And I'm going to have to revisit the movie once again since we've had this conversation, because I'd like to go back and watch how many of the players that were on the court during these games were actually taking jump shots. I mean, if we're talking about 1952, but Bobby Plump hit the shot in 1954. How many players on the court would be taking jump shots as opposed to set shots?
Yeah, that's a good question, because even, you know, in Plump's game, there's on the Hoosier DVD, there's film of the actual real game in 54, the state title game, and a lot of the guys were taking either set shots or kind of the running one footer, which I, you know, if you remember Raid from the movie, who he liked to shoot against Coach Dale's wishes, and he kind of had that. He would shoot off one leg and kind of push it, which was definitely a form of the time. So I think that part was very accurate. And if you watch that DVD of the real game, you did see a lot of guys shooting that, and not a lot of guys shooting jumpers like Plump had.
But Raid had confidence, right? And what do we say about great shooters? You got to have confidence.
Yeah, shoot the ball, Raid.
Shoot the ball, Raid. Another great shooter with confidence is Pistol Pete Maravich. Now you talked about what a prolific scorer he was at LSU, and I don't think a lot of people nowadays perhaps appreciate how good he was. Do you think that Maravich's place in basketball history is solid, or do you think he's, you know, people still wonder how good he was because he was, I think, saddled with the label of being selfish, right? You know, people thought he was selfish, and that kind of affects the way we think about him. But just how do you, or how do people in general, when you were working on the section on Maravich, how do people in general regard him today?
I think you're kind of right with both. I think it's disputed. I think there are, and I sometimes can see, you know, both sides. I think, you know, obviously, especially his NBA career, but injuries were such a huge factor in his pro career that it's really hard to, you know, to gauge what he could have been, because when he was healthy, he had some incredible years in the pros. So I think it's a little unfair there to, you know, the old thing, well, he never won a title, like so many other great players, especially with him. He was never on tremendous teams. But at the same time, you would read about how his, kind of that burden of being Pistol Pete. You know, he could never just be Pete Maravich. He had to be the Pistol. Would, you know, sometimes negatively affect his game. Maybe there would be a bit too much showmanship there, or teammates were a little resentful of his game and him feeling that he needed to live up to that. So I think, you know, I think he's on pretty solid ground historically. I think people are still in awe when they see his numbers. I think, you know, if you just present someone who doesn't know anything about him and you show him his numbers, they're just going to be in awe. And even the shooting attempts, because it's not like he was Steph Curry hitting, you know, 50%. He was taking a lot of shots and missing a lot, but he was taking, you know, 40, 50 shots a game. But that also, I've always felt that, and this is maybe because I like Kobe, and I think Kobe has said this, but it sounds weird, but it does take talent to be able to shoot 40 or 50 times a game, to have that endurance, to have the skills to get open, you know, time and time again when the defenses are focused on you. So I think his college years, I think, and I wrote about this, how I think it's unfair for people to label him, you know, he's a loser, never made it to the NCAA tournament. Well, only one team out of the conferences back then made it into the NCAA tournament. So I think it's really hard to say anybody, you know, to discredit anyone from that era if their team didn't make it, because it was so hard to get into. And he really turned around LSU. I mean, you look at their records before he got there and before his dad took over, and they're just abysmal. And he, by the time he left, you know, they were winning 20 games a year. They were contending against top teams like Kentucky. So I think he deserves more credit in the college years for what he accomplished team-wise, where I think a lot of people will give him credit for the individual numbers, but kind of be like, well, you know, what did he do as a team? But I think he did great with the team, and his teammates in the stories back then would talk about how we need Pete to shoot, and his dad told him, Pete, you have to shoot for us and design the offense. So he was really kind of just following directions, and then also following, obviously, his own greatness, because he just had these amazing skills. And he is one of those players, I think, that you can look at the numbers and be in awe, but it's also just so fun looking at the few highlights that do exist of him, and you wish there were so much more, but just watching highlights of him is just exhilarating to me. You know, I'll call up a YouTube video of his every few weeks just to watch the passes or the crazy shots or the hooks or the... He was someone who would shoot from long distance. You know, you talk about Curry, and he would pull up. So for him, I think it's partly, you know, the numbers we can appreciate, and I think people do, but also he's just kind of those mythical guys that it's kind of tough to place in, you know, historically, because how much credit do you give to someone who, you know, it's not just about the numbers, it's about the memories that he made and that he gave people back then and even today. And you know, I think that's hard to classify, but he deserves credit for it.
So maybe the correct comp here is Maravich to Curry, because you're talking about, you know, Curry and putting him in a class of NBA greats, the uncanny ability to get a shot off from any angle at any part of the court. I mean, we don't really see that much anymore. And you know, you watch old highlights of Maravich, and he was able to do that. And a lot of that was because he had to force up shots because, as you said, the burden was on him to score. But I mean, of all the things, of all the traits that amaze me with Curry is going full circle here, is that he doesn't have to have his feet set. You know, he can be moving, he can be still. He can have defenders in his face, he can be unguarded, he can have teammates who try to defend him, like last night with Andrew Bogut, who tried to block one of his shots and then ran down the court with his arms in the air as Curry knocked down a three. So maybe Maravich, and maybe it's Maravich and Curry that are similar.
Yeah, I think they are in many ways. You know, obviously, like you said, the difference in which we talked about earlier is Curry also just has the incredible accuracy, which sets him apart from Maravich and from everyone else, where, you know, he had those, you know, that amazing ball handling. You know, he goes between his legs, behind his back, you know, steps back, throws it up, and finds nothing but the net. But he can also do it from, you know, everywhere. But he also usually, I mean, he's making like half his shots, and from, you know, there's that crazy number, what are you shooting from, like beyond 30 feet was what most guys shoot from, like 2 feet. So I think it's his accuracy that would set him apart from Maravich, but I certainly think just the flair that those guys played with, and then also their ability to go against, you know, Maravich would have 3-4 defenders kind of chasing after him. And you'll see that with Golden State, and a lot of times Curry, you know, he's such a great passer that he'll just find the open guy, but he's also fully capable of having 3 guys on him and still launching from 35 feet.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, we're all caught right now in the Warrior Curry love fest, so it's easy to jump on board and say we've never seen anything like it. But I am every time I tune in, I am blown away by something different, and it just doesn't seem like it's going to stop. I think we all keep waiting for the train to pull into the station here, and for something to happen where they just don't continue to wow us every night. But it is guaranteed entertainment, and it feels different from the Bulls. What was it, 95, 96? It feels different to me, at least, because and as talented as that Bulls team was, arguably the greatest team ever, you know, with Jordan and Pippen and so on, it seemed like the grind was more evident for them. Whereas with the Warriors, there just seems to be so much darn joy that surrounds the team that it's impossible not to get caught up in it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I wonder if a lot of that, how much it had to do with just, you know, the personalities of their top player, Jordan.
Right.
Obviously, kind of famous for, you know, being hard on teammates, you know, that drive. Not that Curry doesn't have drive, but it kind of just came out in different ways. And I think it's also kind of, you know, I was thinking about this recently, you know, you talk about that joy and comparing it to, you know, I remember when the Lakers, whether they won, you know, in 88, when they were going after the repeat, and that was just this slog through the whole season. And they had Magic, one of the most, you know, fun, imaginative, you know, joyful players ever, but even he was kind of feeling the grind. And, you know, the Heat repeat teams, even with LeBron and Wade, and, you know, they played with quite a bit of joy, but at the end, for them too, it was kind of becoming this drag, it seemed like. And I think that is different from what we see with the Warriors. And I think part of it maybe is just the way they play, you know, the way they pass the ball so well. And I think Kerr probably deserves credit for that too. You know, he's kind of created that environment. And then I think just the way Curry just, like you said, the joy he exudes on the court kind of carries throughout the team. And they all have kind of taken on that personality. So, you know, it will be interesting. You know, the crazy thing is they're still only three games up on the Spurs.
Right.
And they're having this amazing year. So, I mean, they're obviously the overwhelming favorite to win it all. But, you know, there's been all kinds of unbeatable, unstoppable teams in sports history that eventually get beat shockingly. So, you know, anything can happen once the playoffs come around. But right now it's just, imagining that team not being able to shoot like they do for four games is right now seemingly impossible.
Yeah, and the other cool thing about Curry, I don't know if he said this about himself or if somebody said this about him, but I think it was Curry who said this about himself. He was asked about why he's so popular. I don't know if you heard this, but I think he said that part of the reason why he's so popular is because he's a shooter. And because kids can relate more with shooters than perhaps they can with high flyers, because a shooting is more accessible than a dunk. And I thought that was really interesting. I don't know if I'm giving this all to Curry when it doesn't belong to him, or if this is somebody else who was talking about Curry's popularity. But I thought it was Curry because I remember how impressed I was with his self-awareness. But I just think that's really interesting that, you know, part of Curry's appeal with people, certainly young basketball players, is that as a shooter, regardless of your skill set, there's this sense that, well, if I work at it, and here's the nature versus nurture, if I work at it, maybe I can get to be a shooter too. And it's unlike, you know, a lot of us reach our ceiling when it comes to, you know, speed and ability to high fly above the rim and things like that. But there's always this idea now that if we practice, we can hit a shot too. And I thought that was really cool.
No, I think it is, although I just thought, and I can't remember when I was talking to someone, if they said this, and I think that's absolutely true with, you know, you could see kids seeing that, and, you know, you just think of, you know, LeBron, who has every fundamental in the book and is an amazing fundamental player, but, you know, he also has just that physical body that can't be duplicated anywhere, not that we've ever seen in basketball, so that's a little harder for, you know, a kid to see and think, oh, yeah, I'll be the next LeBron, because you can have all his shooting skills, ball handling, but, I mean, you don't have that size and speed, it's going to be a different story. Where with Curry, maybe you can, and I think, delude yourself into thinking, you know, you can be like him. I think I was talking to a guy who said, you know, you can shoot 10,000 hours, you're not going to be Steph Curry still. And that's, like you were talking about, the nature versus nurture, where obviously he put in all that time, but he's still, you know, one in a million or once in a generation. So it's just hard to know if someone goes out there and, you know, does his, if someone took Steph Curry's drill that he does and did him starting at the age of 10 or something, they're not going to become Steph Curry. So what makes someone, you know, become Steph Curry? It's kind of that unanswerable question, I think, but I can definitely see where he is more accessible to play, you know, to kids. And it's one reason why, you know, his jersey's number one, and he's just kind of become this icon now in sports.
Well, I guess the way to put it, the way to settle it, is that he's easier to emulate, right? He's easier for younger players to emulate, because there's this idea that if they work on their outside shot, that they can get to be a good shooter. Now, they're not going to be as good as Steph Curry, because, as you said, he's a once in a generation, perhaps once in a lifetime type player. But, you know, the idea about it's harder to relate to a LeBron type is a really good one, because, you know, you look at just his overwhelming athleticism and physicality, and that's, you know, it on the surface just impossible to match. And so I get the Curry, if we're going to do Curry versus LeBron, I get it.
Yeah, and I, you know, with shooting, the way shooting has become such an important thing in today's game, of course, with the three-pointer being the thing, you know, I think it's definitely good advice if you're talking to a player to say, you know what, become a great shooter, you know, not Steph Curry, but if you're a great shooter, there's going to be a spot for you, whether it's on your high school team or, you know, college team, if you have, you know, the necessarily other skills. But if you can shoot these days, that's just such a valuable skill. It's probably the most valuable at this point. So I definitely think it's something that if you try to emulate, you know, being a great shooter, that's a great way to go about your basketball career now, because shooting has become such a dominant force in the game.
Last one here for you, Sean, and as a son of the Midwest, and it sounds like a fan of the Minnesota Timberwolves, I have to ask you, how many more number one draft picks before the Timberwolves make it to the playoffs?
I guess at least one more this year. my dad texted me, and he gets annoyed with, you know, when announcers say how young the Wolves are, you know, while they're still getting beat by 20 or 30. So it's, I mean, I think they're going to be really, really good very soon, just because, you know, in the NBA, you get a couple great players, and it's just those teams eventually become good. And I think the obvious comparison people have made is Oklahoma City. You know, I don't know if even Towns, you know, he's maybe not at that Durant level, but you get guys like that in Wiggins, and it's not like the terrible teams, you know, have great players on them. So it just seems like in a year or two, they'll be, you know, reaching that hopefully 45 win mark, 50 win mark, and eventually they become one of the elite teams. So I'm hoping next year, but I was also kind of hoping maybe that would be this year. But I think with Towns, especially, and Wiggins, of course, it just seems like in a year or two that they'll be fine. And you wonder how much young talent can you have also, because that's another thing in the NBA. You don't see a lot of, there's just not going to be a lot of young teams that are winning 60 games. It's usually, even Golden State, you know, it took those guys a few years of experience before they became what they are. So I don't know if you can just have nine great young players and be a great team. You kind of need that mix. So hopefully they get that mix without having, you know, obviously have some older players and KG and Prince like that. But I think they might need a little bit more of a mix before they take that next step.
And Karl Anthony Towns, you mentioned him. Part of why he's such a dynamic player is because he's developed the jump shot.
Yeah, and that's, you know, it's kind of a funny thing. Like, you know, the big guy today, obviously the game has changed so much where we don't see those traditional post guys like you used to. And Towns, you know, one thing I do love about Towns is that he is, though, also so good down low. But I think, you know, about Anthony Davis, you know, another great big guy. And I remember last year when Elvin Gentry took over and they talked about how, well, now, you know, Anthony Davis is going to be shooting more three-pointers now. And part of me is like, well, he'll be showing off, you know, that skill. But a part of me is also like, well, then he's just going to be like so many other players. You know, sometimes I just feel like the stretch four position, you know, if you will, all those guys kind of start to look the same, and what differentiates them, where Towns, I think, has, he has shown that jump shot, but he also has shown that he can dominate down low, and hopefully that's still a combination that works in the NBA.
And if all else fails, you can still watch Zach LaVine dunk.
He had one last night, and I think he's going to be pretty, he's got, you talk about the shooting skills as well, and he seems like a guy that, some nights he's just crazy hot, and hopefully that becomes consistent enough, and then you pair that with the unbelievable driving skills, and yeah, he's one of those guys where if he becomes really good, I think that'll take him to the next step, but that's definitely a question mark.
Well, Sean, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me today, and good luck with the book, Rise and Fire, and I'll tell you what, next time I'm driving through Indiana, how about I give you a call, and we'll see if we can find, how many other guys do we need? Just 7, right?
Yeah, if we're doing 4 on 5. Am I going to be on the 5 team that wins?
It depends. I mean, are you going to work on your jump shot, your set shot, your slam dunk? What is?
No, I mean, I think everybody wants to play Jimmy, so I don't want to go there and be Ollie. So,
but he was the best player. You said it yourself.
I know, but I think we all have that image of him airballing that free throw. So, I would take being Raid. I'd be okay with Raid. And
okay,
but shooting the one-legged shot, but
okay.
I mean, everyone wants to be Jimmy.
That's not true. I don't want to devolve and go backwards here, but I grew up wanting to be Buddy because I knew that defense and rebounding was going to get me on the court.
Hey, and they had so many great role players on that team, surrounded by their superstar, but it obviously took all the guys to bring the title home.
Yeah, what kind of gum was he? Is Dentine. Great line.
Yes.
That was a great line. All right, Sean, I appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot, John, for having me.
Absolutely. That's it for this edition of the Passport Play Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or by visiting passportplay.tumblr.com. Thanks for listening, and talk to you again soon.